I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. A campaign for human rights for sweatshop laborers. Sounds like an irresistible force meeting an immovable object. That is, it sounds like conscience bouncing off the inexorable corporate drive for cheap manufacturing in Asia and Latin America. Still, it is what the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has recently tried to do with an initiative to protect factory workers around the world. And fair labor looks like the issue on college campuses around this country nowadays. In some small way, the post-Seattle labor rights activism may just be working. Even Nike, with its 500,000 workers and 565 factories in 46 countries, is feeling the public pressure now, and it's talking about labor standards and monitoring with new groups like Businesses for Social Responsibility and the Fair Labor Association. But getting beyond the rhetoric of responsibility is something else. Other corporations like the Stride Right Shoe Company have already tried and failed to balance a strong social ethic with the demands of stockholders. And the existing international and legal protections for workers have failed to offer any real protection so far. We're talking about human rights in the global marketplace. Connection listeners, how would you reconcile bottom lines with workers' rights? Would you pay more for shirts and shoes and radios that were produced by fair labor? Or would you still opt for Walmart's cheaper sweatshop versions? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest in the studio is Charlie Derber, professor of sociology at Boston College, author of Corporation Nation, among other books. On the phone from Washington is Faris Harvey, who runs the International Labor Rights Fund. Gentlemen, welcome. My general question would be simply, is there room on one planet at one time for this relentless pursuit of low price and for human rights with labor standards? Are these two things that we love reconcilable? Charlie Derber?
That's the question of the hour, Chris. Corporations are increasingly saying that's the only solution. You've got to let corporations move around the world, find the most efficient production, the cheapest goods. And they use the rhetoric now of corporate responsibility, which says that we will treat our workers well because we recognize that when we treat workers well, we get better productivity and we get more efficiency. And there's something very appealing about this new corporate vision that if you treat workers well, there will be a win-win solution and that you can sort of balance these two interests you're talking about. On the other hand, if I can just give a very quick historical take on this, Chris.
Sure.
I think we're in the third wave of corporate responsibility, at least from the point of view of American history. The first was in the 1890s in the Gilded Age, when corporate responsibility was developed by robber barons as a way to protect the enormous corporate power, essentially saying, we can act responsibly with this power. We don't need a government. We don't need unions to help us govern workers. We can, and there are wonderful quotes from John Rockefeller about how God entrusted us with this responsibility. In the 1920s was another huge burst of corporate responsibility when, again, a period quite like our own, corporate power was very, very strong. You had Republican presidents, a golden age of business, and corporate responsibility took the form of corporations providing schools, welfare plans, pensions, a whole range of benefits for workers, saying we don't need the help from outside. We can manage responsibly today. Now, in the current era, since 1980 has been the third great wave of corporate responsibility moving into this global period. And again, it's a period of great corporate power and corporations initiating a discourse about corporate responsibility. But it's more interesting than in the past because it speaks the language of really empowering and engaging workers and other stakeholders to help make business increase the dual bottom line, that is both profits and social performance, human rights and human dignity. Now, the question is that rhetoric seriously and will it really lead to a democratic empowering process? Or is it another example of corporations simply saying, leave this business to us. We can manage it responsibly. Now, on the global scene, corporations are basically going abroad Because they can escape real laws and human rights. It's cheaper because there aren't laws and there aren't rights and there aren't unions. So the real question is, does the corporate responsibility initiative there, is this going to be another way in which basically corporate codes, which look very attractive when corporations say, we believe in human rights, we're going to treat our workers well, we're going to be responsible in the global marketplace, is this another way simply of legitimating the enormous power that corporations have in these countries, where there are basically laws that aren't enforced and corporate codes are in some sense a form of privatized law? Do we want a world based on privatized law? I don't think so. We want law to be enforced by international and national governments. And the question is, can this vision of corporate responsibility be used as a catalyst to really help build independent worker associations, which is the first item in many corporate codes, and to build a public process, which has to be the ultimate solution in creating a political process toward a world based on human rights.
Travis Harvey, I want to ask you in a way, just sort of free associate on that phrase, corporate responsibility. What do you hear in that code?
I hear companies responding to criticism more than anything else, and responding reactively to criticism in a way to try to prevent legislative steps to restrict that freedom that they would like to exercise. Clearly, I think I would agree very much with what Professor DeBar had said, but note that in the 1890s, the corporate responsibility initiatives, in fact, did not succeed and led to the antitrust laws, which led to government legislation to correct abuses of corporate power. And in the 1920s, again, the corporate responsibility initiatives on the part of companies were not successful in developing fair labor standards and had to be followed by legislation that did develop those. Now, the interesting question to me, and I'm not sure I could answer the question, would be, did those corporate responsibility moves in the 1890s and the 1920s lay the groundwork for a heightened public consciousness that then developed into legislative initiatives that held the companies to their claims? If it did, then what we may be seeing now is the initial phase of another move to by companies to try to forestall and legislative controls in a way that will, in fact, lead to legislative controls down the road when voluntary measures prove to be inadequate. There are a lot of other differences in the current global economy now that make corporate responsibility both more complex and more interesting.
Let's talk about what's actually happening out there. I mean, what can anybody point to as a kind of constructive undertaking in this strange contradiction here, cheap labor with corporate responsibility?
Well,
let me ask Faris Harvey. As you survey, the low wage world, Faris Harvey, what's helping?
Well, not very much is helping at the present moment. I think a lot of the corporate responsibility moves and the corporate accountability moves are laying the groundwork for ventures that may in fact succeed. But what is actually happening is that companies have, particularly companies producing goods that are very labor intensive in their production, have fled higher labor costs to cheaper labor, and all the mechanisms that maintain cheap labor have been part of it. That is, government repression, authoritarian government rules, newly urbanizing women workers who are less prepared to fight for their rights than older urban workers, et cetera. All of those are parts of the current world that, plus the very high mobility that, thanks to modern communication information technologies, companies can exercise just very fast mobility in ways that evade most national governments' efforts at regulating them. All of those are really laying the groundwork for both new legislative initiatives in a climate in which states have less power than they used to have, and voluntary initiatives utilizing consumer power. Now, are consumers, the question you opened the program with, are consumers willing to exercise that power in the interest of a fairer world? I would like to think so. I don't think we know yet whether what will the cost be? Because we talk about an increased cost, but we're not sure whether that cost will be fully passed on to the consumers in a world in which corporate profits are pretty excessive and consumer initiatives are very important.
Let me ask you both and give Charlie Derber a crack at it. I mean, we hear of all sorts of different kinds of pressures, monitoring, corporate standards, national standards, government standards at the point of manufacture. The union organization is a big threshold, and consumer activism to sort of check the label. Do you know what kind of a place your sneakers came from? There are other possibilities too, Charlie, but which do you think sort of make real sense in this strange paradoxical confrontation?
Well, it's a great question, Chris. I don't think there's a magic bullet here, but I really believe that the danger of the corporate responsibility initiative is to displace all the other things you're talking about, to make people feel the corporations are going to be responsible. And many of them intend to be. There are many honest people in the business world who want to make this work.
But every time you say that, just forgive me, but they want to be responsible at 3 cents an hour.
Right.
I mean, that's a, you know, I reach for my gun when I hear them say they're being responsible.
Well, the part of the problem is they're working within a framework of capital markets that are relentless. The CFOs of every company are talking to people from Wall Street who are saying, what are the profits like? And they're pushing them down to the extreme. But I agree that the fundamental hopeful possibility here is the building of independent unions and organizations and NGOs that really take this issue up. And the problem is that all over the world in these export zones, terrible places, you know, Dickens-style capitalism, where there are no governments, there are no independent unions, when workers even under the sort of supervision of the FLA, which is the White House Apparel Partnership thing, let me just read you one quote from a worker talking to some Australian human rights interviewers about what it's like to try to organize a worker a union in Indonesia. It's a Nike plant. The factory don't let the worker complain to SPSI, which is the reformist union in Indonesia. They say, "We are family. Any problem, you should talk." This is broken English from. "You should talk to supervisor and not to outsiders." Every time there's a workers' meeting with the factory likes to make some comments about someone who complains often, saying, you are the one who always causes trouble. And then the worker gets embarrassed. It's like pressure. You complain all the time while your work is not good enough. And what's clear is that on the ground, if you go out to these far-out contracting places in China or Indonesia, first of all, most workers have no idea what a corporate code of conduct is. They've never heard of it. I had a student from Boston College who was in Indonesia all summer. And he went with students, and he saw some writing on a wall. It was like the corporate mission statements. There's probably right here at WBUR, there is such a thing on the wall somewhere, I would suspect. And I suspect the meaning
First news first, yeah.
I suspect the meaning of that to Indonesian workers is even more remote than it is to people who work here at WBUR. These are words on walls. For this to get meaning and traction, people on the ground are going to have to take off centuries. This student from, let me just finish this story from Indonesia. This student came back after 9 weeks this summer in Indonesia. He said in the end what he came back with was the feeling of how unbelievably downtrodden these people felt. They had no sense of rights. They felt like white people from the United States were far better than they were. They had been just told, and you know, you can understand it coming from their circumstances. So the only thing that's going to really cut into this in the end is if this process catalyzes a more public process of workers and NGOs developing self-respect and empowerment through a kind of struggle around what the meaning of these corporate codes are.
I want to ask Faris Harvey to, you know, see it from another angle. Is there a nation out there with political leadership that you could actually say is fighting for its people, that wants jobs but is saying, in effect, you're not going to enslave the citizens of X, and we're here to protect our folk?
Well, I think there are a lot of governments that would like to act in that way. But governments in a global economy in which there is about 30% total unemployment or vastly underemployment are under immense pressures to find jobs at almost any cost. And so virtually all the governments, the South African government is a very good example of a government that has tried to develop a code for foreign investors coming into the country, has tried to develop strong regulation, and has found that it's very, very difficult to do that because the pressures of unemployment drive them to take whatever investment they can get under almost any terms they can get it. And those are global conditions. I think, in addition to the unrelenting pressures of the capital market, we have to add the unrelenting pressures of a global unemployment situation, which drives in a downward direction the standards for those people who do manage to get jobs, because there's always somebody around who will take the job at an even lower salary.
You're talking about South Africa. Is there a model nation out there? Poor country, lots of unemployment, got to have jobs, but has sort of put a threshold in.
I don't know of any.
Charlie, do you?
I know a lot of countries that would like to do that. Yeah. I've talked with a lot of labor ministers who would very much like to do that and find that the pressures operating against them are so strong that they can't really put those regulations into effect.
1-800-423-8255 makes the Human Rights and Bottom Lines connection. We're talking about the corporate pursuit of cheap labor at one level and the claims of corporate responsibility and the drive to do something about the sweatshops on another. 1-800-423-TALK is our phone. Archon is on the line.
Yeah, hello.
Archon, good morning.
Morning. How are you, Chris?
Good.
So I wanted to bring up a few things. First of all, the callers, the guests have been stressing the threat of corporate social responsibility as a way to put off or preempt tougher legislation. But I think that it's also an opportunity to press corporations to behave more responsibly and to rethink what kinds of legislation are appropriate and might reinforce that. I mean, one thing that we've seen with the movement for corporate social responsibility is the entry of all kinds of new players who care about these sorts of things, the foremost of which is consumers. And I think that while the guests are right that we don't really know how much consumers really care, a bunch of survey evidence and consumer purchasing patterns show that they care quite a lot and are willing to pay some premium for goods that are made under better conditions.
The caller makes a very good point that there is a movement out there that is very important and that can begin to change some of the equations that we're talking about. We don't know how powerful it is, and until...
How do you register its power?
Well, I think you don't register its power until consumers have real options to make. And at the moment, consumers have options to complain about abuses that they know, but they don't have positive options to choose over against less responsible companies in most industries. So it's still early to know whether this movement will achieve more than fringe. I'm very much a part of it, and I certainly hope that it will. But I am realistic enough to know that we're dealing with very large marketing forces as well as capital and labor forces.
Hmm. Archon, thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Is the connection phone. Hans is on the line.
Oh, hi.
Welcome, Hans.
Hi. My question was, for people who work, 60 hours a week, have two kids, are busy, how do we buy responsibly? Is there a website? Is there a quick reference we can use? Or is the only way to buy made in the U.S.?
It's an interesting question. I mean, there's a drive afoot to label shirts or sneakers in a fashion that you might know a little something. How can you know, Charlie Dever?
Well, there are a tremendous number of websites that try to give scorecards to companies. There's the Center for Economic Priorities in New York, which has a website, scorecards, every corporation in terms of its responsibility. A lot of social investment funds do the same thing. An informed consumer has a lot of screens out there to try to do this. Chris, if I could just go back one second to this idea of how strong the movement is. It seems to me the critical thing is this corporate responsibility initiative going to build this popular movement? There's a movement, a meeting in Prague, as you know, as we talk, that's starting up, which is talking about debt relief. The debt relief if implemented, that they're talking about, which will significantly alleviate debt in 40 of the poorest countries of the world, will do more for the lives of those workers you're concerned about than all the corporate responsibility that we're talking about so far. What's
the connection between the two?
Because right now, the enormous debts which are carried by countries in Africa and Asia and around the world are preventing those countries from spending the most minimal monies on social services, schools. There are rickety schools without walls. There are no health clinics. If you're concerned about the well-being of these workers, remember, 3 billion people in the world today live in abject poverty. They don't have clean air. They don't have access to medicine. They don't have the minimal amenities. And so the larger conditions that are producing this kind of extreme poverty cannot be modified simply by better corporate codes on the walls of places like WBUR. It's got to be done through a large-scale social transformation. When Kofi Annan suggested a global corporate compact at the UN, he was correct that this ultimately is going to require a world based on dignity and human rights. It's going to require an international set of human rights truly enforceable. But Kofi Annan is under a lot of pressure for suggesting a global compact with 50 multinational corporations, which include, I believe, Nike and Shell and some of the worst offenders, because people don't believe that. In the case of Annan's suggestion, this international compact for corporate responsibility has no enforcement mechanisms, no monitoring mechanisms. It's all based on the idea that the corporations will sign up to sponsor certain UN initiatives. This is not going to be enough.
Let's talk about this. I mean, people have heard of the Kofi Annan initiative. What is the pressure on him? Obviously, there's the pressure of the problem, but how did the Millennial General Assembly respond to his words?
Well, you know, I think it was very important during the post-Seattle protests in Washington at the IMF and the World Bank, at the Group of 77, which was meeting in Havana at the time, which is a group of third world countries, came out very strongly in support of the protest against globalization as it's taking place today, which kind of undercut the Tom Friedman New York Times view that the movement in the North is essentially speaking for the South against their own interests. Here was the South saying, we are in favor of a different model. And when Kofi Annan made this proposal, many leaders in the South, and you saw it in the New York Times 2 days ago, the leader of Gambia came out and said, this is reimposing colonial slavery on, that is, they're sort of giving the green light to corporations to come in and mine the resources, privatize the water, and so forth. There's a lot of reaction against this that's growing among third world countries.
Hmm. Ferris Harvey, do you want to add to that?
I would completely agree with the point that is being made. The efforts, I think Kofi Annan is responding to some very strong pressures to show that the UN can do something in this area. The ILO has been debating this for several years and has not yet been able to find a way to utilize any of its very important expertise in exerting any sort of real pressures on companies. So it's a response in the midst of a virtual vacuum of governance in this area. But it's certainly going to be an inadequate response and may well, as a number of third world governments believe, open the door to further exploitation rather than control or limit it.
1-800-423-8255. We're talking about sweatshops and corporate responsibility and human rights and bottom lines. 1-800-423-8255. Sarah is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome, Sarah.
Hi. I just want to be able to report a little glimmer of good news on that I witnessed this weekend. I went to one of those super store, I don't know how you describe it, it's a new hardware store / home design center. I won't mention its name, but it just recently opened in Burlington. And there, among the huge piles of rugs, was a pile of Oriental rugs, and large on the tags were the sign that says these rugs were not produced with child labor. I was cheered on two fronts, one that I had choices as a consumer, but more importantly that here a large corporate entity felt that this was a good marketing tool and it was in their best interest to market these rugs as such.
Hmm. Did you believe the label first off?
Well, I would like to believe the label. Should I not?
I have no idea, Charlie.
Let me say a word about that, if I may. I serve as president of the Rugmark Foundation in the U.S., which is the only independently verified labeling program for perennial carpets. There are a lot of manufacturers that put that on automatically without any sort of monitoring, either by themselves or by anyone else. So, unfortunately, Sarah, you can't trust a label just by itself unless there's some sort of verification of that label. And at the moment, the Rugmark program is the only program that does that. If it was a Rugmark label, you can be relatively sure that the label is honest. Otherwise, carpet manufacturers in Pakistan and India and Nepal are beginning to recognize that that's a good marketing tool, but without any verification, it often has no relation to reality. I just got back from 2 weeks of looking at the Rugmark programs in those three countries.
Yeah, I mean, what did you see there?
Well, I saw that the programs are working well, that the incidence of child labor is down somewhat in the industry as a whole out of some fear. But in countries like Pakistan, a lot of the manufacturers are moving their production into very difficult areas to monitor, like Afghanistan refugee camps or the Northwest Territories, where there's very little peace and order.
Faris Harvey, stand by. We're talking about corporate responsibility in the global economy. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com. From Boston University, this is I'm Christopher Ledin. This is The Connection. We're talking about corporate responsibility and what it means in a world of cheap labor that makes so much of our apparel and a building movement of conscience about it. What's to be done? What can be done? Or are these inexorably conflicting forces? 1-800-423-8255 makes a connection with Charlie Derber, author of Corporation Nation, professor of sociology at Boston College, and with Faris Harvey, who runs the International Labor Rights Fund in Washington, D.C. Jim Shabarasi joins us. He manages the worldwide sourcing of New Balance shoes. He deals with the factories that make the shoes all over the world. New Balance, which thinks of itself as a good guy in a difficult world. Jim Shabarasi, how do you do it?
Hi, Chris. Thanks for
Welcome.
Having me on. The way we do it is by working actually very hard at programs that we formalized over the years and generally drive with our factory owners to create an environment in which we have increasingly have continuous improvement happening at these various factories.
Give us a walk through the factory here. I mean, what do you insist on as sort of basic standards? What are people getting? What do you add to the bare minimum?
Sure. Well, we have formal programs around child labor, harassment in the workplace, health and safety, non-discrimination, wages, benefits, working hours, the usual things. As we've made progress on those fronts, we've also been fortunate enough to add some creative pieces to this. I think similar to what your two guests have talked about, we've moved to add libraries at the factories. And in these libraries, we have newspapers from provinces in China, for example, from provinces from the interior part of China where many of the workers come from. And you find that the workers there are in there reading about what's going on back home. We've added drug stores. We've debated with factory owners over even putting in telephones, for example, so workers can call home periodically. And the telephone experiment, as it started out, has been highly successful. People at the beginning lined up to to make those calls back home, where the factory owners originally had argued with me that, you know, telephones would not work in that environment. It was just too expensive to have people call home. But once we convinced them or worked with them to put a bank of telephones in, and the lines were huge, what happened was the factory owners themselves took the ball and ran with it and added more and more of these telephone banks. We show movies once a week, twice a week sometimes, put restaurants in at one of the factories we're in, and I've continually asked for things like green space, place where people can relax, workers can relax, have a picnic, take a walk, and we've seen these kinds of things develop among the various factories that we're in.
Sounds good, Jim, but it also makes you wonder, what are these people being paid as an hourly wage?
Well, again, the wages are things that, that one has to be very, very careful about measuring. The real problem with wages is that even in a place like China, which has fairly well-defined federal law regarding what wages, what minimum wages should be, you have to concern yourself with two things. One is the strict interpretation of how you get to what is a minimum wage, and secondly, whether that minimum wage is something that we can call a living wage or not. So what we did is we very carefully defined our standards below the notion of what wages should be, and we review this monthly with all of our factories, and we continually push things forward.
Well, I'm dying to hear a number.
The numbers run from 25 cents to 40 cents an hour is a fairly typical situation for training workers up to more experienced workers in a place like China.
Do you mean to say it doesn't go below 25 cents an hour?
25 cents is about the minimum. I have certainly seen cases where it would move below that, but we have moved with the factory to address situations when we do see that happening.
I mean, the fringes are fascinating, Jim. I got to say respectfully, but if you were paying American workers 25 cents an hour, you could give them all Pebble Beach golf course as their green space. I mean,
sure.
You could afford a whole lot of movies and restaurants and phones home at 25 cents an hour.
But these aren't American workers, so you're dealing in an...
They're American customers. I mean, their shirts are part of our world, or theirs.
Yeah, but we're dealing in an economy in which these people have no economic benefits from where they come from. They don't have a chance to earn that kind of money, and frankly, 30, 35 cents in a place like China, plus the room and board, and this environment is actually a good salary for these people.
Obviously, the big benefit to your bottom line here is the incredibly low wage. But what do the add-ons, the New Balance creative touches that you described, do for your bottom line, do you think?
Well, I think, actually, we've seen extremely good results. It's interesting, Chris, as we walked into this program and the formalization of our social responsibility program, we felt there would be economic benefit. There would be economic benefit through the quality of the product coming out, through productivity. However, what we found was that there was much more economic benefit than we estimated at the beginning. What happened is that we ended up retaining workers at a much higher level than we had, than these factories had accomplished prior to that time. So the factories previously were spending a great deal more money on training workers, new workers, to replace workers who left. So that was one aspect of it. Their overhead rates were higher at the factories themselves, just from training. Secondly, by retaining a more skilled workforce, we saw productivity increase. We saw productivity increases that approached 30%, sometimes exceeded 30%. Hmm. And we saw quality that was much better. Within the factory itself, we saw quality rework issues that went down substantially. And it just the factories began to run much more smoothly than they had been prior to that time.
Jim, let me ask, if you were putting the sort of the New Balance record, these things you're describing, on a label to make your sneaker a little more attractive to a kind of conscientious American buyer, I mean, what is it you'd be bragging about? This shoe was made in a factory with a restaurant for the workers?
No, I mean, it's no, I don't think we'd be bragging about that. But, you know, I think we would certainly say things that we've accomplished fair treatment of the workers, workers who earn a good wage within the country and within the economic system they live within, and which help to provide these workers with respect for themselves, a decent living condition while they're working at the factory, and a chance to grow their economy, a chance to grow themselves into better earners in their lifetime.
Jim Chabarasi, stand by, would you? Jim Chabarasi manages the relationship between New Balance, the sneaker folks, and the factories that make them around the world. Dara is on the line.
Hi. I was have a comment on Jim's discussion. I was in China this summer inspecting Reebok and Nike and several other factories. And interestingly, the thing that I heard over and over again was that the worst factory in Guangdong province where I was a Reebok, a New Balance factory was the worst factory. And that it had the reputation of being the really bad factory. And so managers kept telling me, go look at that factory. That's the bad one. And it raises an issue which came up earlier about this rug example also. It's really difficult for consumers to know which is the good firm and which is the bad firm and to distinguish between the PR and the real change. That really, for me, a big problem, and this leads into my question, is that it's really difficult for us to know what factories really are doing, what they're paying, what the benefits, what the hours, what the health and safety is, and that right now the industry, both the apparel and the shoes and toys and electronics, are hidden behind a veil of secrecy, that these industries are not transparent and they're not accountable to the public. And so my question, really directed at Ferris Harvey, is how can we promote transparency in this industry? How can we find out more about not only factory locations, which is just coming out, but factory conditions, what's really going on in these factories? And then the next level is how can we open up these monitoring programs? How can we improve the quality of monitoring that's going on and make monitoring transparent and accountable so consumers really can trust that what they buy is really something that they believe in and that they can feel good about buying?
Ferris Harvey, go for it.
Garrett, I asked the question is to answer. We have to make these processes more transparent than they are. Clearly, opening up the location of factories to the public is an interesting start, because it does open up the possibility that somebody might actually, in an unplanned way, visit a factory and find out what's happening. But more important, I think, is the development of credible and respected monitoring systems that have sufficient transparency for their accuracy to be determined. None of the systems that are currently being developed have that full transparency yet, and I think the consumer and movement pressure to increase that transparency is an important part of moving that process forward.
Ferris, how are you? I'd just be interested in what you make of efforts at the New Balance level, say, at a single corporation, and a good guy like Jim Chabarasi to do it on a sort of one company let's be creative about this, the narrow possibilities here. How do you score that?
Well, I think what they're engaged in is positive. I'm not critical of it. I did happen to notice, however, that the one matter that he didn't mention as a part of their code was any sort of worker empowerment, either through trade unions or collective bargaining. And I think until workers have an ability to negotiate with companies, we won't know whether they feel really good about the wages they get or whether they feel really bad. Workers are not in a position, particularly in China, for example, to undertake collective bargaining, even though the law of the land allows it. And in circumstances of extreme fragility for workers, where they might easily be fired by raising questions, as the quote from Indonesia reminds us, it's very difficult for individual workers to express themselves. so that collective action is a necessary part of any sort of advance of worker empowerment.
Jim Chabrowski,
I didn't hear that from Jim.
Jim, let me ask. I mean, if you felt, if your manufacturers in China, say, felt pressure to organize, to act collectively, what would they be able to do about it?
Our code, I did not describe everything in our code. Certainly there is a clause in there in which there will be no discrimination, and the factory can show no discrimination against workers based on their political affiliation, their union membership, or these kinds of activities. We would definitely not discriminate or try to put down such an effort. Our efforts, however, are not political. They are definitely there to create a better working environment for the workers. And that's where we stick really to that side of it. If I might also talk about, comment on these issues of transparency and monitoring programs. Frankly, in our factories, there are any number of NGOs or other organizations that we know have been in there. And it's a matter, it's the way it works. There's nothing we can prevent. I don't care to prevent it. I mean, it's nothing I want to prevent. We even have our own organization. That's a nonprofit organization, which comes in and audits as well on our behalf.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other things we try to do to make sure we're in contact with the worker is we have on my staff some very high-level, well-educated Chinese nationals who are there every single day, and they're there talking to the workers, and they have established a suggestion box.
Mm-hmm.
And we see some quite good things coming from them, from the suggestion boxes, and we keep in touch with the workers. By the way, that also is an effort. You don't, on the day that you put the suggestion box up, you don't necessarily get suggestions. We've found factories which said, don't put it to the workers, don't put anything in there.
I remember suggestion boxes in places where I worked, and I never put a suggestion in. I never thought anybody would have read it if I did, but I want more callers here, Jim. Stand by. Jeff is on the line.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think one way to move the ball forward here, you have to have some leverage. And what we observed in the mid-90s was when the newspapers started reporting on this, starting with the Kathy Lee Gifford story, then you had some at least movement, as you say, rhetorical mostly, but at least some movement by these corporations. But now, since the newspaper coverage has fallen off, the leverage I see out there is with the students that have these bookstores full of imported logo merchandise, and they're pressuring their universities to get involved. And actually 60 schools have joined to form this workers' rights consortium where students, you know, are out there and they're trying to get a handle on how this production is being done.
This is the one that was too much for Phil Knight at Nike.
He blew a gasket. He called in a $30 million promised pledge to the University of Oregon, his alma mater. He froze negotiations with the University of Michigan, a $25 million deal for putting the logo, the Nike logo, on their athletes, and yeah, he had a tantrum like the other Knight, Bobby Knight, got fired for. So, you know,
those Knight boys.
I really think that this is a bright spot because right. There is this leverage, and these students, as Charlie mentioned, you know, he had a student out in Indonesia this summer, and I know at least a dozen, maybe closer to two dozen students that were out there, and some are going out on Fulbrights this year who have already graduated from the student anti-sweat movement. So I really think that this is where you've got real pressure that can be brought to bear, at least on a few labels, and I think the knock-on effect could be significant.
Yeah,
Jeff, thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. This is Charlie Derber. I just want to say I think you're right on the ball that what moves this process forward always is incredibly relentless public pressure. The students, this is probably the closest to a sort of Vietnam-like struggle on American campuses today that we've seen in 20 or 30 years. And it's made a huge difference, which you saw at Seattle. There's got to be equal pressure coming from the media. The media has got to be on this thing all the time. You've got to have consumers, and we haven't talked about institutional investors, unions, churches, all these people with huge amounts of money in the capital markets that can sway corporations. Mm-hmm. But this thing is never going to move forward if this is not perceived as the dominant justice movement that is going to bring together all these groups. This is a women's issue because these are women workers. 80 to 90% of these workers we're talking about are women between 16 and 24. This is an environmental movement because these plants are an unregulated environmental thing. This is the one movement that has the possibility of integrating all these fragmented social forces that have not found common ground since the Vietnam War. So there's just no doubt that what is going to push this forward is relentless transparency, disclosure, and mobilization, with probably students taking the lead on this both here and in these countries.
1-800-423-8255 is our phone. Jennifer is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Jennifer.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm glad to add to this discussion because my point was just brought up with, regarding gender, and I wanted to make a comment adding to that. I'm a sociologist at the College of William and Mary, and I do research in this area, and I, too, am very much inspired by the student mobilization around these issues. But I just want to remind us, the word worker keeps being used in these discussions, and I do want to call attention to the fact, again, like one of the guests mentioned, that 80 to 90% of the workers here are women. Many of them in places like where I do research, Honduras and Nicaragua, are single mothers. And this is a very important point. Over and over again throughout history, and indeed right now, we see that the needs of women workers are not the same as men workers. So the word worker doesn't completely capture what needs to be looked at here. And any movement aimed at social transformation needs to look beyond this gender-neutral notion of worker to the issues facing single mothers, to the issues facing young women who are migrating from rural areas. And
so, Jennifer, what is your notion of effective pressure?
My notion of effective pressure? Well, one thing I would want to bring up is this idea of collective bargaining as being the only or a main goal. And I want to challenge that because in collective bargaining, we do not because of gender social structures, we do not necessarily hear women's voices or women's perspective. The women's movements that I do research on and have worked and cooperated with in Nicaragua call upon this over and over again, that tripartite night negotiations does not include women. And what you see are male union organizers going in and organizing these women without regards to the fact that they're not only facing high degrees of unemployment, but they're facing basically patriarchal structures that mean that they are solely responsible for feeding their children. So that's a whole other area. And here's where I think that targeting the IMF is not a misguided idea, because the loans that these countries have incurred mean that they spend less and less money on social services, and who benefits from a lot of these social services? We know women and children are often some of the main beneficiaries.
Charlie Derby, do you want to answer for the patriarchy here?
Well, not exactly. I think you're right that the solution is in global changes of rules that catalyze the Seattle movement, which allow these developing countries to find some tiny level of leverage to take care of their own basic needs, which are so desperately being neglected. I do think, though, I would take issue in the Maquiador region on the Mexican border, women taking the lead in a lot of the labor movements. And it just seems to me that in the end, as in the New Deal, as in the progressive era, you're going to need incredibly publicly supported notions of a labor movement. You've got to resurrect the idea of a labor movement led by women, led by women around the world, who take this social corporate responsibility movement and say, this is a movement for justice that belongs to the people. It doesn't just belong to consumers. It doesn't just belong to women. It belongs to citizens of the world. And I would come back to Kofi Annan. In the end, the only solution to a world based on not on cheap labor but human rights is going to be some form of global economic governance where people act as global citizens, not as market participants, but global citizens to take back the world for people rather than just for money.
I'm going to remember that, Charlie. You got to resurrect the idea of a labor movement, probably led by women, for women first and foremost. We're going to come back to this subject. Charlie Derby, thank you. Thank you, Faris Harvey. Thank you, Jim Shabarasi. And thanks to the callers. You can continue the conversation about corporate responsibility in the global Marketplace on our website at theconnectiononeword.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Legal Seafoods, presenting a new location at Copley Place on Level 2, serving fresh seafood in a fresh new decor. Legal Seafood. If it isn't fresh, it isn't legal. Citizens Business Partners Checking. Appointments to meet with a citizen.